3. The Religious Rite. On a Sunday afternoon of November 20th, 1938, millions of Americans tuned their radio sets to one of the country's most popular weekend programs. The sounds of a church organ and a choir followed. Soon, a familiar and sonorous voice came to the airwaves. It was that of Detroit priest Father Charles E. Coughlin, one of the country's most popular and controversial media figures. For years, Coughlin had courted controversy with increasingly political statements and criticism of the Roosevelt administration. Today's address would be his most provocative public utterance yet. Coughlin quickly launched into a startling defense of Nazi Germany's policies toward the country's Jewish population, which had culminated in the recent violence of the Kristallnacht pogrom that left nearly 100 people dead and shop windows smashed across the Reich. Claiming to oppose persecution against all religions, Coughlin insisted that Nazism was merely a natural response to the threat posed by communism. Picking up a Nazi publication, Coughlin listed 24 Jews he claimed had been integrally involved in the Russian Revolution. "I speak these words holding no brief for Germany or for Nazism," he said, "simply as a student of history, endeavoring to analyze the reasons for the growth of the idea in the minds of the Nazi Party that communism and Judaism are too closely woven for the national health of Germany. Do I make these references?" Nazi violence against Jews was therefore the result of the fact that the Jews, through their native ability, have risen to such high places in radio, press, and finance. "The Jews might be a minority in Germany," Coughlin continued, "but a closely woven minority in their racial tendencies, a powerful minority in their influence, an aggressive minority which has carried their sons to the pinnacle of success in journalism, radio, and finance." He went on to blame Jewish bankers for financing the Russian Revolution, naming the financial firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company as a specific offender. He concluded by supporting President Roosevelt's recent decision to withdraw the American ambassador from Berlin to protest recent anti-Semitic violence, but added, "If we are sincere, we'll call all ambassadors and ministers from communist countries." By now, Coughlin was used to the controversy his fiery radio speeches generated. He often managed to use such storms to raise money. Yet the obvious affinity between his remarks in November 1938 and Nazi ideology generated the largest conflagration yet. New York station WMCA, which had surreptitiously managed to obtain an advance copy of the speech, programmed an immediate follow-up broadcast by the director of the non-sectarian Anti-Nazi League. A cascade of angry calls and telegrams poured into Detroit station WJR. The chancellor of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Detroit was quoted in the press the next day saying, "Coughlin spoke for himself, not for the church." Detroit Jewish leaders were outraged, with one denouncing Coughlin's address as one of the most vicious talks that I have listened to in a long time. There was soon a backlash against the backlash, however, when WMCA announced that it would no longer carry Coughlin's program due to the religious and racial hatred and dissension he was stirring. 2,000 Coughlin supporters descended on the station to demand his reinstatement. For months afterward, protesters carrying pro-Coughlin and occasionally anti-Semitic slogans showed up at the station doors on Sunday afternoons to keep up the pressure. Coughlin was in many ways a pioneer in American mass communication history. For years, he had used increasing fame to build one of the first multifaceted media empires. Through the emerging technology of radio, he quickly built a following of supporters who not only tuned into his program on a regular basis, but were willing to support their belief in the radio priest with real-world action. Coughlin expanded into publishing a newspaper, Social Justice, with a circulation of more than 200,000 in 1940, though he claimed it to be closer to 1 million. In many ways, Coughlin established the model for the indignant, belligerent, no-holds-barred talk show hosts that hit the airwaves in every American city in the late 20th century. Glenn Beck's rants during the Barack Obama years about cabals of shadowy global elites, later illustrated with chalkboard flowcharts on his Fox News television program, could have been pulled directly from Coughlin's playbook. Yet Coughlin himself was far more successful than any of his future emulators. A December 1938 Gallup poll found that a full 22% of Americans reported listening to Coughlin's radio program in the previous month. A majority of those said they had listened to him 2 times or more in that period. This figure translates into an estimated monthly audience of nearly 29 million listeners, with nearly 15 million listening more than once a month. These are astonishing numbers, especially given that Coughlin's broadcasts that year were only carried by 46 independent stations, with no network backing on the East Coast. No stations west of Kansas or in the South carried his program. Historians have estimated that his audience was the largest in the world and far surpassed that of every major radio star of the era, and was possibly the largest of all time. By comparison, the most successful talk show host of later years, Rush Limbaugh, commanded a peak audience of more than 20 million in the 1990s. Limbaugh loudly proclaimed himself to have talent on loan from God, but his religious predecessor would have had a better claim to a divinely delivered audience. What made Coughlin's voice uniquely resonant for millions of Americans was fundamentally his religious message. He was, after all, an ordained and practicing priest who had instant credibility with Catholic listeners. Much of his popularity lay with Irish and German immigrants on the East Coast, who had been badly hurt by the Depression. He referred to himself as your spokesman and presented himself as standing up for the common man against vested interests ranging from international banks to the Roosevelt administration. Coughlin's radio talks were flowery, emotional, and misleading, historian David H. Bennett has written. He knew all the tricks of the propagandist, from name-calling to glittering generality. Propagandist or not, by 1938, Coughlin had convinced millions of Americans that he understood their problems as no one else could and was giving them a voice. For all his appeal and success, however, Coughlin's influence was intrinsically limited by several factors. First, he was a Catholic priest in a country where serious anti-Catholic sentiment still existed. While the shared experience of anti-Catholic prejudice no doubt heightened his appeal among his Catholic listeners, those outside the fold had a harder time accepting the word of a priest. Or worse, Coughlin himself had crosses burned on his lawn by local Ku Klux Klan members when he first arrived in Michigan. His audience undoubtedly included Protestants, but the influence of any Catholic on the national level would have an upper limit. Second, Coughlin was not originally American at all, having been born in the Canadian province of Ontario. This might have been trivial for his radio listeners, but it made him constitutionally ineligible for the presidency. This would become a major issue in 1936. These limitations also meant that no matter how popular he became, Coughlin would always face rivals peddling similar messages. Throughout the 1930s, a series of demagogic leaders rose to national prominence with religiously based, anti-Roosevelt messages of economic equality and, later, non-intervention in the European War. Dynamic Kansas minister Gerald B. Winrod ingratiated himself to Midwestern Protestants and then took his message nationwide with a series of lectures and radio broadcasts. By the late 1930s, he joined Coughlin in defending Nazi Germany and denouncing the Jews. Winrod no doubt hoped to position himself as a Protestant Coughlin, but fell short in his ambitions. Crowding the stage further was Gerald L. K. Smith, a veteran political organizer who worked closely with Louisiana demagogue Huey Long and then took his show on the road after Long was assassinated in 1935. Smith's message had been honed and battle-tested in the Louisiana swamps. Like Long, he was a populist firebrand who railed against economic and political elites while simultaneously denouncing communism and throwing in a mixture of anti-Semitism and old-time religion. He was such a fiery and charismatic speaker that he would overshadow even Coughlin during public appearances. What these men shared was not only rhetorical style, but similar messages. All three promised radical economic change. They identified similar, if not identical, causes of the Great Depression. Economic elites, politicians, and Jews. Ironically, both Coughlin and Smith were heavily influenced by Henry Ford, arguably the most important economic elite in the country, but himself a well-known anti-Semite. Each became a staunch opponent of Roosevelt, and similarly, all three fell into becoming a friend of the Third Reich. By 1941, each man had voiced admiration for the new Germany and expressed support for Hitler's anti-Semitic worldview. There is evidence that the German government, in turn, recognized the potential significance of these religious demagogues in shaping American public opinion. What made these men uniquely resonant for many Americans was their use of religion. The United States of the 1930s was still a deeply religious nation, though denominational affiliation and participation in churches dropped significantly during the Great Depression. Hearing pro-Hitler sentiments, seemingly supported by quotations from the New Testament, had a powerful influence on many of the faithful, who responded by opening their pocketbooks and donating their hard-earned cash to the cause. Hitler's friends thus used the deep-seated religious devotion of Americans to further their political aims and spread anti-Semitic prejudice and pro-Nazi views at a critical moment in the country's history. Much like the modern-day religious right, Coughlin and his associates were not content to exercise their authority in the spiritual realm alone. The radio priest was political from nearly his first day on the airwaves, and directly entered politics during the 1936 presidential election. Winrod ran for the U.S. Senate as a Republican in his home state of Kansas, on a platform that was widely denounced as having more in common with the Nazi Party than the GOP. Smith was fundamentally a political organizer who used religious rhetoric to frame his messages. Ironically, with the possible exception of Hitler's agent on Capitol Hill, the Führer's religious friends were the most directly active in American electoral politics. The U.S. government was slow to realize the unique threat they posed to national security, but once the danger became clear, it responded with overwhelming force. The ultimate fear was that the Coughlin, Winrod, and Smith factions might manage to unite their forces and join with the German-American Bund, or later, America First, to create a broad far-right coalition that would include demagogic leaders with fanatical followers and an armed paramilitary wing. As with the Bund and its fellow far-right groups, however, a combination of egos and philosophical differences prevented such an alliance from forming. The United States government would never have to face the full threat these groups might have been able to pose. Of the three men, Coughlin was the most likely candidate to fit the bill of future American Führer. He made a major push toward political power that was only derailed by his own missteps and, ultimately, the church hierarchy. Charles Edward Coughlin was born in Hamilton, Ontario, to working-class parents of Irish ancestry in 1891. The young Coughlin was raised as a devout Catholic and entered the seminary in Toronto. He was seen as an outstanding student. After a few years teaching in Catholic schools and colleges, Coughlin was sent to the Detroit Diocese. In 1926, Bishop Michael Gallagher, who would become the most important figure in Coughlin's career, decided to establish a shrine in the suburb of Royal Oak, then about a dozen miles north of the city. There were only a few Catholic families in the area, and the anti-Catholic Klan was prominent. Local KKK members welcomed Coughlin and his new church, the Shrine of the Little Flower, by burning a cross on its front lawn 2 weeks after it opened. Coughlin decided the best response was to make the shrine glamorous and exciting for the public. He convinced a sympathetic local baseball scout to bring some big-name players to the shrine to increase its public profile. Impressively, the scout not only delivered appearances by Detroit Tigers players, but also set up visits by New York Yankee stars, including Babe Ruth, the following summer. Thousands turned out to see the Yankees legends, who collected money from star-struck visitors at the door. Coughlin netted $10,000 from the stunt, and more important, established a public profile as a celebrity man of the cloth. A 1928 story in the Detroit Free Press, published during the World Series, referred to Coughlin as a rabid baseball fan himself and a close personal friend of Babe Ruth, Harry Heilman, and other famous players. Ruth and his Yankees swept the series that year, making Coughlin's alleged friendship with the Bambino all the more impressive. Coughlin's big break came in September 1926, when he sat down for a meeting with the station manager of Detroit radio station WJR. The priest's initial pitch was for a religious program that would raise awareness of his church and help combat Klan prejudice. The station manager agreed to give him the time for free, but Coughlin insisted on paying for it. Bishop Gallagher gave his own blessing to the idea. The radio priest's first broadcast was on October 17, 1926, just days before his 35th birthday. He was an immediate hit. As one sympathetic biographer has written, his voice registered well over the radio, and his enunciation was unusually pleasing. First, there was a musical program, and then he spoke. He was a knockout, radioically speaking. This was the same basic format Coughlin would use throughout his radio career, and his on-air presence would only improve with practice. Visitors from all over the country, and later the world, began converging on the Shrine of the Little Flower to see Coughlin preach in person. His weekly congregation steadily grew. So too did the donations, which soon came pouring in through the mail from all over the country and even overseas, as his fame spread. Coughlin hired an army of female clerks to deal with all the correspondence and the money flowing into his coffers. To give his followers a sense of identity and encourage their continued support, Coughlin created the Radio League of the Little Flower. Membership cost $1 a year, about $15 in 2018 terms, putting it within reach for all but the most impoverished listeners. All the proceeds were considered charitable contributions and were therefore tax-free under federal law. By 1928, Coughlin was meeting with New York architects to plan the construction of a grand new church in Royal Oak, including a huge tower with a crucifix emblazoned on each side that would include his personal office. It would become the center of his national radio empire. Coughlin now expanded his radio presence, in part to help raise the cash needed to build his monumental edifice. He bought time on stations in Cincinnati and Chicago, augmenting his weekly reach dramatically. The timing was impeccable. In late 1929, the stock market crashed, plunging the country into the Great Depression. Coughlin's popularity had always lain with the poor and the working classes of the country's big cities. These groups quickly felt the brunt of the downturn, as jobs disappeared, savings accounts vanished, and homes were lost to foreclosure in astronomical numbers. The radio priest suddenly found himself not only providing spiritual counsel to his audience, but also voicing and shaping their political responses to the turmoil. In early 1930, Coughlin changed tactics to move away from biblical teachings and focus on denouncing socialism, communism, and kindred fallacious social and economic theories. It was a fateful decision. In fall 1930, Coughlin negotiated an agreement with the CBS radio network to put him on 16 stations across the country. This gave him a potential weekly audience of 40 million. Coughlin's political views were now heard nationwide. The level of fan mail arriving in Royal Oak skyrocketed, as did donations. Coughlin had gone from being an obscure Michigan priest to becoming a household name across the country in under 5 years. This was a dangerous road to be walking in the early 1930s, however. Loudly denouncing socialism and communism could attract a radio audience and donations, but it increasingly drew Coughlin into the purely political realm. In early 1931, Coughlin planned to use his time on CBS to denounce the Treaty of Versailles that had ended World War I, and the international bankers supposedly profiting from it. This was a commonly understood code for Jews. CBS got wind of the plan in advance and asked Coughlin to tone down the remarks, and he accordingly offered to focus on a completely different topic entirely. When Sunday afternoon came around, however, CBS executives tuned in to hear Coughlin denouncing their own network for their attempted intervention. Over the weeks to come, Coughlin attacked the bankers repeatedly. This was an act of astounding arrogance that understandably upset the network's leaders. CBS announced that it would be pulling the plug on Coughlin at the end of the current season, with no chance of renewal. Coughlin then approached rival network NBC, but its leaders similarly refused to let him buy time. This might have been the end for Coughlin's radio career had it not been for Bishop Gallagher. Rather than order the priest into silence or ask him to tone down his rhetoric, Gallagher encouraged him to find an alternative outlet to spread his views. Coughlin subsequently pieced together a plan to buy time on 11 stations. This eventually grew to 27 across the nation. The expensive arrangement cost him $14,000 a week, nearly $300,000 in 2018 dollars, all of which was covered by donations from listeners. Coughlin was now free from the content restrictions imposed by CBS. His voice would continue to be heard across the country as long as individual stations would allow him to purchase time. In 1931, Coughlin used his newfound freedom to level direct attacks on President Herbert Hoover. Coughlin argued that Hoover's plans to alleviate the Depression were inadequate and inhumane, no doubt echoing the sentiments of millions. The following year, Coughlin met Democratic nominee Franklin Roosevelt personally and endorsed him at the Democratic National Convention. In January 1933, President-elect Roosevelt met with Coughlin again. The priest reportedly offered advice for Roosevelt's upcoming inaugural address, much of which was probably ignored. It was perhaps inevitable under these circumstances that Coughlin would turn his personal interest in radio program to an extended discussion of economics. After all, his endorsement of Roosevelt had been based on the hope for new policies to combat unemployment. "It is Roosevelt or ruin," he told anyone who would listen during the campaign. Once in office, the new president's policies quickly disabused the priest of any hope that radical economic measures were on the horizon. Coughlin argued that the president should quickly begin minting money and back it with a combination of gold and silver. This would in turn create rapid inflation that Coughlin believed would eliminate debt, reduce unemployment, and improve agricultural output. Similar policies were advocated by British fascist leader Oswald Mosley and American fascist intellectual Lawrence Dennis, discussed later. The notion of dramatically inflating the dollar flew in the face of economic orthodoxy and was swiftly rejected by banking leaders and the Treasury Department. Stung by the administration's rejection of his ideas, Coughlin began to harden his views toward Roosevelt and the bankers he increasingly believed were pulling the president's strings. The administration did not take this criticism lying down. In 1934, the Treasury Department dramatically revealed that Coughlin's secretary personally owned 500,000 ounces of silver, making her the largest individual silver holder in Michigan. It later emerged that the Radio League of the Little Flower had partially funded this huge purchase. Any increase in the price of silver by using it to mint coinage would thus have resulted in a massive profit for Coughlin's church and his associates. Angered by Roosevelt's rejection of his ideas, Coughlin now threw his lot directly into the political ring. In late 1934, he announced the foundation of the National Union for Social Justice, an interfaith political organization designed to bring social change while resisting communism and socialism. He drafted a 16-point manifesto that called for the nationalization of public resources and abolition of the Federal Reserve. He later laid out a plan calling for the government to make massive investment in roads, dam building, and reforestation efforts. This was, in effect, a much larger and more radical version of the economic recovery plans the Roosevelt administration itself was proposing. One important difference, however, was that Coughlin believed this all might be achieved quickly if the interference of bankers could be circumvented. The country's financial establishment, he increasingly believed, was standing in the way of recovery for the average American. Late in the year, Coughlin took this message further and shocked listeners by telling them that there was little hope for the future of capitalism and democracy in the United States. The only chance to avoid falling into communism or fascism, he told them, was through adopting his social justice platform. This was a radical move. Coughlin was now effectively calling for the U.S. government to be replaced with a new regime of his own design that would take radical steps to end the Depression. The analogs with Hitler's economic policies were obvious. Since taking power in 1933, the Nazis had poured huge amounts of money into military spending and infrastructure projects, along with reintroducing military conscription for men. The result was that by mid-1936, unemployment had all but disappeared in the Third Reich. In March 1935, the former head of the National Recovery Administration, General Hugh S. Johnson, made the Hitler-Coughlin comparison in searing terms on national radio. "Someone sent me a parallel of what both you and Adolf Hitler proposed and preached, and they are as alike as peas in a pod," Johnson told Coughlin. "As a foreign-born, you could not be president, but you could become a Reichsfuhrer, just as the Austrian Adolf became a dictator of Germany." These barbs did little to staunch public support for Coughlin. National Union for Social Justice meetings attracted thousands of supporters. Branches sprung up across the country. By late 1935, Coughlin claimed to have more than 8.5 million supporters signed on to his 16-point agenda. Months later, he announced that another 5 million people had joined the National Union. Historian David H. Bennett has estimated the organization's membership at well over 1 million, but lower than Coughlin's estimates. However many people actually signed up for membership, the priest's influence was undeniable. A 1936 Gallup poll found that a full 7% of Americans, around 9 million people, would be more likely to vote for a political candidate simply because Coughlin had offered an endorsement. 20% said they would be less likely. This was substantial influence to wield for a man who had never held political office. "He has become dangerously important," a biographer wrote in 1935. "He has become a mob leader, and all such leaders are sources of worry to the more sedate and conservative minds of a people." Sober economists may scoff at the anti-capitalist, anti-banking, anti-international league views of Father Coughlin, but they cannot laugh off easily the acceptance by millions of his homespun doctrines, political, economic, and social. Coughlin now sailed directly into the headwinds of national politics. He was far from the only voice promising radical economic and social change. In Louisiana, governor, later senator, Huey Long had become a national figure by promising to share the wealth and give every American $5,000 a year. Long's populist slogan was, "Every man a king," and he was widely seen as a potential rival to Roosevelt in the 1936 election. By late 1934, there were dark whisperings in Washington that he and Coughlin were planning to strike some kind of pact to combine their movements. It was not to be. Long's career was dramatically ended by an assassin's bullets on the steps of the Louisiana State Capitol in September 1935. But his message and tactics lived on. Long's most prominent successor was Gerald Lyman Kenneth Smith, a former Midwestern preacher who moved to Louisiana and turned his attention to politics during the Depression. Smith was an outstanding speaker who could reputedly hold congregations and audiences in rapt attention. He gradually fell in with Long's organization and became the apostle who converted masses to Longism, in the words of one historian. Long was regarded as a very good public speaker. Smith was seen as outstanding and frequently overshadowed his boss. After Long's assassination, Smith delivered a moving graveside eulogy before making a power grab for the reins of the Long Empire, as the FBI put it. He was unsuccessful and forced out of Louisiana by rival claimants to Long's crown. Smith then took his show on the road, traveling the country to heap scorn on Roosevelt and dub the First Lady "that female Rasputin." He eventually began working with Francis E. Townsend, a retired physician who had built a national following by pledging to pay out large monthly pensions to the elderly on the condition that every penny had to be spent in the following month. This economic stimulus would supposedly end the Depression and net huge tax revenues for the government at the same time. The Townsend plan was clearly outlandish, but the idea of extending old age pensions and generating economic stimulus sat well with Coughlin's wider political program. Townsend and Coughlin agreed to an alliance in late 1935 to create an anti-Roosevelt, anti-Wall Street political coalition. Months later, a Coughlin representative approached Smith and asked him to join the combined movement. Smith agreed, hoping to use the opportunity to further his own political career and potentially even launch his own bid for the presidency. Critically, he agreed to appear and speak at the National Convention of the Union Party, a new political organization Coughlin would shortly be launching to put his agenda in the national spotlight. Coughlin believed that by combining his supporters with Townsend's and Smith's factions, he would be able to influence up to 20 million votes in the 1936 presidential election. It would not be enough to win the presidency outright, but it would make Coughlin one of the biggest power brokers in the country. Coughlin accordingly launched the Union Party in summer 1936. Its platform was nearly identical to that of the National Union for Social Justice, though Coughlin toned down some of the more socialist-sounding proposals. The new party faced two immediate and crippling challenges. The first was finding a viable presidential candidate to stand in the election that was just months away. Coughlin's birth in Canada made him ineligible for the office. He also would have faced an uphill climb as a Catholic, especially in states with heavy Klan influence. Asserting control of the party with a dictatorial fist, Coughlin decreed that its nominee would be North Dakota Congressman William Lemke. Coughlin liked the Republican because he had introduced a radical agricultural relief bill that called for the Farm Credit Administration to buy up the mortgages of foreclosed farms and reissue the debt at much lower rates. The Roosevelt administration viewed the proposal as dangerous economic meddling and ensured its defeat in Congress. The embittered Lemke now threw his hat in with Coughlin and Townsend. No one seems to have believed that the Union Party could actually win the election outright, but by combining their forces, its leaders hoped they might be able to ensure Roosevelt's defeat, or even deadlock the Electoral College and send the election to the House of Representatives. Even if victory in 1936 was out of reach, there was still 1940 to think about, too. These rosy predictions would prove naive, largely because of the second problem the Union Party's leaders encountered. This was the inevitable clash of personalities and egos within its leadership. Coughlin and Smith were the first to fall out. Weeks before the Union Party's national convention, both men addressed a gathering of Townsend's followers in an effort to enlist their support. Smith spoke first, pulling out a Bible and unleashing a tirade of vitriol while he flailed both arms wildly in the air. The crowd was thrilled and vocally cheered his applause lines. "The lunatic fringe is about to take over the government," Smith proclaimed proudly. Coughlin addressed the gathering the next day. Following Smith was an unenviable task for even the best public speaker, and even at his personal best, Coughlin was more effective behind a microphone than in front of a live audience. His speech fell flat. 2 weeks later, both men spoke again at the Union Party convention. In an odd twist, one of the invitees was Congressman Martin Dias Jr., whom Coughlin offered to endorse at the convention. It does not appear Dias accepted. Smith whipped the crowd into a frenzy, stripped down to his shirt sleeves, and with sweat pouring down his face, viciously denounced the Roosevelt administration as a slimy group of men culled from the pink campuses of America with a friendly gaze fixed on Russia. The crowd roared its approval. Coughlin's speech could once again hardly hold a candle in comparison. Outdone at his own event, Coughlin vowed he would never again appear on the same stage as Smith. The wider country viewed these developments with a mixture of incredulity and concern. Left-wing columnist Dorothy Thompson condemned the Union Party as proto-fascist. Lemke, Coughlin, and Smith attacked the moneyed interests of Wall Street, the gold standard, and the reactionaries, socialists, communists, and radicals. But they reserved their greatest vituperation for advanced liberalism, which they lump with socialism, Thompson wrote. So did Mr. Hitler. In October 1936, Smith fully embraced the label of anti-democrat by announcing that the Union Party was no longer sufficiently radical for his tastes. He proclaimed that he now intended to directly seize control of the country by unspecified means. He was expelled from the Union Party and assaulted days later in New Orleans by unknown attackers. He began to hint publicly that there was an assassination plot against him, evoking the specter of Long's death years before. An FBI informant reported that Smith was simply an extreme egoist and is definitely out to benefit himself only. Who would give public speeches in favor of any group which will support him financially. Another reported that Smith was very fond of liquor and aspired to be a dictator. He admires Hitler's cause and has made the statement that when he gets in power, he will set up a system of stormtroopers in the United States to take care of the Jews. Whatever chances the Union Party might have had evaporated with Smith's antics. Roosevelt won re-election easily. His Republican opponent, Alf Landon, received just 36% of the vote and won two states. Lemke received 892,000 votes and carried no states. Coughlin was devastated and wept in his church office as the results came in. In the following days, he disbanded the Union Party and announced he would no longer broadcast his ideas to a seemingly ungrateful nation. Privately, he blamed Smith for the loss and denounced him as a viper and a leech. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Coughlin's radio silence would be short-lived. On January 1, 1937, he put out a New Year's Day message stating that he was willing to resume his program if there was public demand. Weeks later, his protector and patron, Bishop Gallagher, died. Gallagher's dying wish was reportedly that Coughlin should resume his broadcasts. The priest accordingly did so, but a new dynamic had emerged in the church hierarchy. Gallagher's successor, Bishop Edward Mooney, was far less sympathetic to Coughlin's activities and saw it necessary to denounce him in print when the broadcasts resumed. Coughlin continued to publish his more outspoken views in social justice, but even that was becoming tricky. Coughlin's audience was changing at the same time. His listeners before 1936 included disaffected Protestants and even some Jews who were attracted to his economic populism. Many of these listeners tuned out after the Union Party fiasco, leaving him with primarily Catholic audiences on the East Coast and in the Upper Midwest. Coughlin also faced increasing competition from imitators who realized that his message could be used to build similar and equally fanatical followings. The most prominent of these emulators would be Gerald Burton Winrod, a pale imitation of Coughlin, who would nonetheless make a name for himself as one of Hitler's top American fans. Coughlin and Winrod were similar in many ways. Both were men of the cloth who used the language of religion to build their support. Both took a direct interest in politics and sought political power. By the late 1930s, both were using anti-Semitism to further their political agendas. At the same time, Winrod was in many ways everything Coughlin was not. Unlike the Detroit priest, Winrod was an entirely self-educated fundamentalist Protestant who built his following in America's rural heartland. This made him both a potential ally to Coughlin and a rival simultaneously. The similarities were obvious to thoughtful observers. Winrod started out with a purely religious message, but suddenly he achieved an interest in politics and started after the New Deal with somewhat the same appeal as that adopted by Father Coughlin in his latter period. As one Kansas newspaper put it in 1938. Winrod was born in 1900 as the son of a hard-drinking Wichita saloon owner. The elder Winrod, piously named John Wesley Winrod, had been compelled to flee his native Missouri after a drunken brawl and settled in Kansas. He calmed down slightly when he married in 1899, but still enjoyed carousing. The Wichita saloon he tended was so notorious that it reputedly became the first establishment targeted by militant temperance campaigner Carrie Nation, who joined her followers in kneeling to pray before smashing up the venue with hatchets. The experience was evidently enough for Winrod to abandon not only selling alcohol, but also his own consumption habits. He turned to religion instead. A decade later, the young Gerald's mother was stricken by cancer and underwent a crude double mastectomy. Facing almost certain death in the era before antibiotics and modern chemotherapy, she soon developed a severe morphine addiction and became increasingly withdrawn from the world. Their lives changed one evening as her now devout husband prayed over her, and he claimed some form of divine intervention occurred, whereupon she was cured of both her drug addiction and her cancer instantly. Whatever the truth of the story, the elder Winrod committed his life to the ministry a few years later, and his son would harbor a lifelong suspicion of doctors. Now convinced that divine intervention was the only way to be healed, the family refused to even have medicine in their home, let alone consult physicians.